these fighter pilots are they're tailor-made for a good story. They're individual heroes involved in individual battles, like the Knights of the Round Table or the gunslingers of the Old West in America. There were just a lot fewer Japanese pilots, a lot fewer Japanese aircraft. Sort of the golden age of the making of aces, that was over.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. We're ready for takeoff.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to this episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Bill Yen. Bill is a highly acclaimed author of over three dozen books, mainly focused on historical and military topics. Bill has already authored three books on the Pacific Theatre, one of which is the acclaimed book, MacArthur's Air Force. In this episode, we're going to talk about America's View, Marine Aces of the South Pacific. Bill, welcome to Extended.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you for joining us all the way today from the San Francisco area.
Yeah, from right in San Francisco.
Wow. Okay. Well, thanks for joining us. I know you're a really busy guy. I did have a little look through your back catalogue, Bill. There's some fabulous books in there. But let's talk about your up-and-coming book. And you open it with a description of the term ACE, and in particular referencing the United States context. Can you explore that with us here?
Yeah, the term originated in the First World War with the French, and the term ace came to mean a fighter pilot who had shot down five or more enemy aircraft. And in the early days, the enemy aircraft might include balloons as well as fixed-wing aircraft, but by the Second World War, it was strictly fixed-wing aircraft. And the five or more, it was somewhat different from country to country. How can that be, you might ask? Could five be different here than there? But in some countries, if two or more fighter aircraft had shared in shooting down an enemy, the pilot who had taken the lead in that action would get the full credit of one. How the United States differed was in that they issued fractions. So if two pilots were together involved in a battle and they shot down one enemy airplane, then each of those two would get 0.5. And if three were involved, then it was 0.33 and so on,
right,
and so on,
okay,
and so on, which is why American ace totals tend to have, his record was 7.83741, you know, that kind of stuff. But it's confusing and it's a little obscure, but it's also, I think, more fair.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that. So let's go on to talk about the group that you focus on here, the U.S. Marines. Why pick this group, Bill? Because there's lots of books written on the Pacific Theater. There's lots of books written about aces in the Second World War. There's lots of books about Marine pilots. Why the need for this focus, do you think?
Well, the idea that I had, which has to do with the title, was to compare this group of pilots to the pilots of the RAF, who Winston Churchill famously referred to as the few. Never in the course of human history have so many owed so much to so few, and those few were the fighter command pilots who fought the Luftwaffe in the Battle of Britain.
Yeah,
and I compare this bunch of Marine pilots to them in that they too were few, and that while the RAF pilots were fighting over their own country, the Marine pilots were fighting against an enemy far, far away. But it was a circumstance that was no less dire. Was a threat to the Japanese juggernaut that had swallowed Southeast Asia and most of China, or most of the coastal China, and threatened to dominate the entire Far East. And had they succeeded, this might have gone on for decades. They were very close to strangling the supply lines into Australia, and that could very well have happened. But a line was drawn in the sand on an island called Guadalcanal, and the Marine ground forces, or amphibious forces, landed on Guadalcanal, and the Japanese juggernaut, the Japanese war machine, moved no farther than Guadalcanal.
Yeah, and that ground war continued with the arrival of the Marine pilots as well. And they were often flying whilst being attacked from the island itself, weren't they?
Yeah, there were numerous aerial victories, vast aerial battles that took place right over the airfield. Yeah. And it was very, very close quarters. And in the late summer and fall of 1942, Marine pilots were vastly outnumbered. Yet the Marines were there when the U.S. Army Air Forces were not. They did not have the critical mass of air power to handle this task. So it fell to the Marines more by accident than by design.
Yeah, Bill, that was a question. Sorry to interrupt you there. I was going to ask you, because it seemed an odd place to find Marines fighting air to air. You know, Marines and Marine support tends to be air to ground, but the point at which they arrived, there was no doubt about it. This was an air to air war, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And as I said, it was accident rather than design. They were, as you rightly point out, the mission of Marine air power is to support the troops on the ground. But in this case, supporting the troops on the ground meant fighting the Imperial Japanese Navy Air Force for air superiority over Guadalcanal, because without some measure of air superiority, or at least challenging the Japanese aerial superiority, there just would not have been the ground campaign would not have succeeded.
And they came up against aircraft like the Zero. They were in heavier aircraft. They had to learn very, very quickly, didn't they, new tactics, how to take on this highly maneuverable aircraft, lots of them coming at them. lots of different types, and there was no taking advantage of settling in, was there? From the day they arrived, they were up against it.
No, there are numerous cases where pilots were in aerial battles on the day, or in some cases even the moments that they arrived in Guadalcanal, and they were flying Grumman F4F Wildcats, which were, as you pointed out, heavier than the Zero. They were not as maneuverable. The Zero was a remarkable airplane for the time. It was very nimble and in the hands of good pilots, and Japan did have good pilots at that time. They were very, very maneuverable and very deadly for their opposition. The Marines, they learned to use the advantages of the Wildcat. Its speed in a dive, its firepower, its robustness. The Zero's Achilles heel was that it was, and part of the reason that it was light and nimble was that it lacked armor. There was no, for example, American fighters were designed with an armor plate behind the pilot seat. So if an enemy airplane got on their tail, this armor plate would protect them from being attacked from the rear. Yeah. Zero did not have that. So if you were able to use your power to dive onto a Zero and get behind him and fire from his 6 o'clock position straight behind, you had a good chance of destroying the Zero.
Yeah, okay. Well, let me come back to that then, Bill, because I want to go back and just learn a little bit about where some of these, before we talk about some of the characters, because I think that's the great thing that comes through here, is the individuals that became these aces and super aces. But on the whole, they were pretty ordinary folks, weren't they, who came out of the West and the Midwest from pretty humble backgrounds, and you make in the book some great length to tell their stories, I suppose you cannot go any further than not start with Boyington and an individual like that, but they all came through similar routes, didn't they?
Yeah, they were I wanted to tell their backstory. I wanted to talk about where they were from and some of their experiences growing up. For the most part, they were from the West and the Midwest, relatively few Easterners, and most of them were from small towns or rural areas. There were a few from cities, but relatively few. And men who had grown up with a sort of against a backdrop of independence, of being on their own, learning to manage with their own wits and their own skills, and honing their skills and hunting, for instance. That's something that is very, very much part of growing up in the West and, yeah, and the Midwest, even yeah, today. And that was something that a lot of them had in common. So it was that sort of, the cliched American rugged individual. That it's a stereotype, but I think that a lot of these guys fit that mold.
And, that ruggedness, that challenging behavior, and I suppose that unorthodox route to what we would recognize as becoming aircrew, became some of their greatest assets, didn't they? You mentioned hunting there. That really came home with some of them in terms of their accuracy and their reflexes and things like that. And I think one of the great things I learned was a lot about those individuals. And it wasn't all good. You know, these are not all heroes growing up as Sunday school choirists. You know, some of these come from tricky backgrounds. But they all had something in them that made them really special in the air, didn't it?
I think that's true. They all had that that sort of intangible something. When you look at the number of the pilots who went through the flight schools in this country, the Navy, which included the Marines and the Army Air Forces, there were tens of thousands of pilots that went through those. And I think that the skill of these individuals, they rose to meet the circumstances that they were handed, and they excelled. And that's why we're writing about them. For every one of them, there are five or 10 who we don't write about, who are merely the, almost footnotes to these stories. And looking at the stories of these guys, there were lists of other names. This particular man from this particular place, he was on that mission, but he got shot down. Or he freaked out and was not able to engage in combat. But we never hear those stories. We only hear about the ones who became heroes and who succeeded with large numbers of aerial victories.
Well, let's pick some of these out then, Bill. I want to talk about the Cactus Air Force. I'd like to hear about the Black Sheep as well, and some of these characters. Let's start with Greg Boyington. Before the war started, was, and I quote, a poor aviator, an alcoholic, and in perpetual debt.
Go ahead.
What comes through in his story is real character. It didn't stop him. You know, he went out and became a volunteer in China. Really made his own way, didn't he?
He did. And you mentioned that he was a poor pilot, and that's one thing that is not true. He was everything else you said is true. He was a womanizer. He was a drunk. He was an alcoholic. He was disrespecting of authority at every turn, but there was something about him that, even though his whole life, his whole personal life and his professional life was a train wreck, when he got in the cockpit, his skills as a pilot were so extraordinary that it's almost uncanny how different he was in the air than he was on the ground.
He
had multiple wives. He had this terrible, terrible drinking problem. But as you pointed out, he did volunteer to fly with the Flying Tigers in China. But as we know, the Flying Tigers in China were not noble lads fighting for world peace and global victory. They were bounty hunters because they were paid a $500 bounty for every Japanese plane they shot down. But he went there and he did that. He risked his life. He came back claiming that he shot down more Japanese planes than he actually had, which is something that also tars his legacy. But again, that's something that's another aspect of his persona that is just so terribly negative.
But he did go on to be a multiple ace pilot.
He was. He shot down in his career at least 22 enemy airplanes. He he claimed to have shot down 28, but there are in the book I go through all of the all of the individual incidents that he claimed that may not have been true, and but he was he did command the VMF 214, the Black Sheep Squadron. He did extraordinarily well with them. There were a number of aces that came out of that group. He was in the air. He was a good leader. He was a good tactician. He had an intuitive understanding of aerial combat, and but on the ground, he'd last long enough to get to the nearest whiskey bottle, and then he would be fighting and.
Yeah,
and brawling and just incorrigible, and he had to be bailed out a number of times by commanders who believed in his skill in the air and thought that trumped his horrible persona on the ground.
His men looked up to him because they recognized that skill, didn't they? And the myth and legend around some of these aces, as they built up the number of kills, made them idols, certainly back in the US. And, you know, you catalogue the press quite extensively in the book and how they followed these individuals, desperate for a story, for a hero, for somebody to take back and show the great stuff they were doing.
Yeah, these fighter pilots are tailor-made for a good story. They're individual heroes involved in individual battles. It's like, and I made the comparison in the book, it's like the Knights of the Round Table or the gunslingers of the Old West in America. They were individuals who did individual battle, who achieved individual victories, and they were quantifiable victories, each one of these. And it was easy for these war correspondents out in the South Pacific to fall into the rhythm of counting the victories. Did so-and-so score a victory today? If so, he's now ahead of the other guy. And and so this sort of race of aces one ace reached 19 and another reached 20. And then what will happen the following day? Will the guy who got 19, will he shoot down two more and be one ahead? Or will he himself get shot down? This is just, it's wonderful storytelling. And the war correspondents and their readers, and especially their editors, loved this stuff. So that's why these people became household names.
And when they, we missed out so many big chunks of the story as I jumped around. I do apologize for that. But sort of first phase of the defense of the Guadalcanal area, and particularly the Henderson Air Base, came to, and they were rotated back to the US, that press bandwagon followed them, didn't it? And I think what shone through for me was, I don't know if humility is the right word, but they were ordinary folks and couldn't quite understand why they were being put on these pedestals because, you know, in their eyes, yes, you know, there was a bit of a competitive edge to this, but there was also the terrible gore, the death, the agony of war that they were facing. You know, I think almost all of them probably suffered what we now know as PTSD, and yet they were coming back through this media machine.
Yeah, they were not. They in some cases had a hard time with suddenly becoming stereotyped heroes. Joe Foss, who was probably the if you take some of Pappy Boyington's numbers with a grain of salt, as most people do. Joe Foss, who was the highest scoring Marine ace of the war, he referred to it as a dancing bear act. It was almost like they were being treated as circus performers. They were brought to these press conferences, and reporters, were asking the questions like, how does it feel to be such a hero? How does it feel to be so wonderful? And you get enough of that, you start to get a very jaded impression of your own importance. And they still felt like ordinary people, but the headlines said that they were supermen.
Yeah.
And of course, fame is fleeting. As each group of aces returned to the States and went on these dancing bear tours, there was another group of Marine aviators had arrived over there, and they were starting to achieve their scores. And so it was, and the older aces became, they were pushed from page one to page four and yeah. So on. So that was another issue. And
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Did you know that the first G-suit for British pilots was essentially a chest-high pair of fisherman's waders which were filled with 2 gallons of water? The water automatically squeezed the pilot's legs as positive G was applied. Did you also know that the Islamic Republic of Iran Air Force's oldest McDonnell Douglas F-4D Phantom is set to clock up more than 70 years in service, having been delivered in 1968 and now subject to life extension programs taking it to 2040? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
And as the war in that area progressed, Bill, what we saw was a very different type of air-to-air battle, wasn't it? Because in those early days when they were literally fighting for their lives to defend those airfields on Guadalcanal, where there were numerous Japanese attacks of varying aircraft types. But as the war progressed, the challenges changed, didn't they? So
it was
slightly harder for the others to rack up the numbers, and were having no less a challenging time, and were seeing no less of a horrid war, but different circumstances.
Yeah, the war in 1942 the Marine pilots were drastically outnumbered, but several things were happening. First, there was the American production effort was able to replace losses faster and faster. In the early days, if they had lost a plane, and it took a long time to replace it. But gradually, by early 1943. That was no longer a problem. Also, the number of pilots was growing. Simultaneously, the Japanese, who at one time could send dozens of Zeros escorting dozens of twin-engine bombers to attack the ground and air positions on Guadalcanal to attack the Marines, gradually that started to ebb, because Japanese production could not keep up with the losses. And this gradual change took place through 1943. Meanwhile, on the ground, or on the sea, ground and sea, the U.S. Navy was gradually chipping away at Japanese naval strength, and the ability of the Japanese to continuously reinforce their own garrison on Guadalcanal, because the Japanese owned half of Guadalcanal through this whole period. The front lines were just a few miles from Henderson Field. But gradually as the U.S. Navy grew in strength, and as the Marine ground forces gradually were able to capture all of Guadalcanal and then march up the line of islands north of there through the Solomons, that took away from the Japanese, and it also added air bases that the Marines could use that were closer and closer to the big Japanese strong point at Rabaul on New Britain, which was really the power point of the Japanese occupation of the South Pacific.
Yeah.
And it was untouchable by the Americans in 1942, but gradually the Marines were able to take the war to the Japanese in New Britain. And then the other factor was the arrival of the Vought F-4U Corsair, which was a much more powerful airplane. It was had a huge R2800 engine in it. It had longer range, it had more power, it had more maneuverability than the Wildcat. So that was another game changer. So it was really those series of factors that gradually changed.
That's a really fascinating insight, Bill. Thanks for that. And there were so many questions in all of that. Let me just go back a little bit to looking then at some of the individuals. We talked about Boyington. There are so many, and the book religiously lists all of the kills in a lot of detail. So I do highly recommend that people read that, because it's full, jam-packed, end-to-end flying action. But let's pick out one or two of the other aces that are featured in the book. Colonel Joe Bauer, he was a double ace after two missions.
He was.
Medal of Honor holder. I didn't believe, like, obviously I did, but I was quite enlightened learning about how many of these aces, you know, shot down 3, 4, 5 in single missions.
Yeah, there were a lot of multiple victory missions that were flown by these aces. Joe Bauer was an interesting character. The book highlights the 18 or so top scoring aces of that period, all of the double digit aces. Bauer was the only one, he was the oldest among this group. He was also the only one of them that had graduated from the Naval Academy at Annapolis, or any service academy. And he was one of those people who was a victim of his own immense skill. His path to a career in aviation was inhibited by his skill at sports, and he was called back from his military career to serve as a coach at Annapolis, and that's where he got his nickname, Coach. And then when it came time to start leading forces into the South Pacific, his immense organizational skills got him sidetracked on the way to the South Pacific in setting up the organization for the support bases, the bases that supported the operations on Guadalcanal, who's setting up the training, setting up the logistics. And all of the time, he was anxious to get into battle. And then the famous story is that when he finally led his squadron to Guadalcanal, they were all landing practically out of fuel. And there was the Japanese were attacking an American ship and just off of Guadalcanal. And instead of landing, because he was out of fuel, Bauer went and engaged the Japanese and ended up shooting these guys down. And
that's
so
a story that's an absolutely amazing story. But he wasn't only a fantastic fighter pilot as well. He was a brilliant leader as well, wasn't he? And I think, you know, sidetracked. They saw that.
Yeah, and he was sidetracked to be in charge of air operations in on Guadalcanal, and all the time wanting to go in. There's a saying in American sports where if you're a player, you're urging the coach to put me in, coach, put me in the game, coach.
Yeah,
and here's Bauer, who was the coach, and he's anxious to put himself in, and so. And then the way he died was so poignant. You know, if there are any movie producers out there looking for a good story, here's the coach. He was finally put into the game, and he winds up being shot down, and he survives the crash, and his fellow pilots are able to see him down there. He's in his life vest, and he's safe in the water. And he's pointing toward an island, and they assume that he's going to try to swim there. And it's the end of the day, and it's getting dark. They're unable to get out there to pick him up. The next day, they go back, and they search all the islands nearby. They look everywhere, and he was never seen again. He doesn't show up anywhere in Japanese records as having been captured. His body was never recovered. Nobody knows what happened to him.
But these guys were coming down in shark-infested waters as well, weren't they? There's stories in the book of injured pilots in the sea being surrounded by sharks.
Yeah, and a lot of them didn't live to tell about it, but some of them did. I think one of the more amusing stories that I like is the story of Manny Siegel, who was shot down and ended up being confronted by an albatross who landed in his life raft. And he was you probably read that story, and he thought, well, I'm going to be stuck in this life raft. I need something to eat. So he ended up killing the albatross. And of course the comparisons to Coleridge and his killing the albatross. And well, it didn't work out quite the same way for Siegel. He eventually was repatriated and flew more missions.
And he was on my list to ask you about next, because the war moves up through the Solomons, as you described, and new aces were created. You know, you've got Donahue, you've got Walsh, Gus Thomas. They just kept coming, didn't they?
Yeah. And it's... As you point out, it reached a point where these two curves on the graph of the increasing number of American pilots and the decreasing number of Japanese pilots meant that a point of critical mass was reached by the roughly the beginning of 1944, after which there were just a lot fewer Japanese pilots, a lot fewer Japanese aircraft. So the sort of the golden age of the making of aces, that was over. But there are some, you mentioned Walsh, who ended up scoring his final missions over he was among those who scored scored victories over Japan and Okinawa in the final months or even weeks of the war.
And that was quite an interesting development, wasn't it, Bill? Because the Marines, I suppose, returned to what they were supposed to do, which was carrier-based flying. As the war progressed, we said they were less shore-based and more sea-based.
Again,
a very different type of air battle.
Yeah, the idea of and all of these pilots who fought on Guadalcanal had carrier training, because the idea was that Marines could be based aboard carriers, and then they would be present to be able to fly the attack missions to support the Marines on the ground. And again, it was just accidental that they wound up being a land-based air force on Guadalcanal, but they did revert to carrier operations. Although, curiously, with the advent of the kamikaze threat in 1945, the Marine pilots found themselves back in the air-to-air mode.
Just fascinating, and I really, really enjoyed that. Where can we find you online, and where can we get hold of a copy of this book?
Okay, my website is my first and last name, Bill Yenny, BILLYENNE.com, and I've got links to most of my books on that website. I haven't got this one up yet, but my friend Jeff Bezos, I'm just kidding, Jeff Bezos, who is not my friend, who has not invited me to fly in his spaceship.
There's a bit of disappointment there, I hear.
I wait by the phone. But Jeff has a website called Amazon. And if you go to Amazon, the title of the book is America's Few. Again, an homage to Churchill. And the book is going to be released in early January. And I hope that all your listeners will buy it and enjoy it.
Well, I certainly did, Bill. So thanks very much for that little insight. And as I said, there is a real amount of data on all of those air-to-air kills. You catalogue them all. You catalogue their lives. And it's a real fabulous way of, A, understanding a bit about the air war around the South Pacific, but more importantly, understanding those individuals.
Yeah, I was lucky to have access to the aircraft action reports from each of these squadrons. So I had the actual words of the actual pilots recorded, written down within hours of their air combat, and I think that having had that, I was able to really bring this to life. The phrasing, the way they spoke about it was just in some cases chilling, and I tried to use as much as possible of that in the book.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Bill. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon, as well as the wider extended family of supporters, including the Aviation Historian. You can find me, Peter Johnson, at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Gareth Timonelli on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. And that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Bill, and it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
X Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
It's taken me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a store being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.